We welcome in from Defector.com, the co-host of the Distraction Podcast, David Roth. And David spent last week in Pennsylvania, and so we discussed during the break, what's a good Pennsylvania song? Philadelphia Freedom, Carrie suggested Allentown, and my reasoning was, I bet David despises Billy Joel, so let's go with that.
Well, first of all, I do, so congratulations to you on correctly adducing that. Although, I also think this is, we were in the Poconos as a team, and I got to hear my coworker, Diana Moskowitz, sing Allentown karaoke at the very end of our retreat.
Wow.
Which really changed my way of thinking about the song to a certain extent. Not to say that it would be better if Billy Joel was a better journalist. I think he's probably a better singer than Diana. I think she'd agree with that. But it was, a whole new sort of perspective on it. I think the reason mostly that I have been grumpy about Billy Joel in my life, beyond the narcissism of small differences issues that New Jersey has with Long Island, which I will freely cop to, is that he was kind of inescapable. Like when I was going to summer camp and stuff, it was like I was from New Jersey and everybody I went to summer camp with is from Westchester County or Long Island in New York. They all had the same Billy Joel CDs and thought it was weird that I wasn't just jamming to Stormfront every night. And I think I never really fully got over it.
That made it all worthwhile. Other than that, how was Pennsylvania?
It was good. I mean, it rained like most of the entire time, but it's weird. I've never been in a position at any job where I was important enough to be included in any kind of like company offsite meeting. You know, like people do it. My wife's company does it all the time. And, you know, they go and they talk about the next year and what they're going to try to do. And they look at charts and all that stuff. And every job that I've ever had has mostly been just sort of like just being hungover in an office setting. And everybody kind of politely ignores how obviously hungover I am. That was like the first 15 years of it. And then I got some staff writing jobs and nobody felt compelled to, you know, ignore that I was hungover anymore. And they could just make fun of you at that point. But the idea in this case, I mean, because of the way Defector is and because we all own it together, it was a bunch of, you know, blogger goofballs getting together and trying to be serious about the future of our website. And I left feeling pretty good. And then also it was nice the last day, so we could, whatever, grill burgers and watch our coworkers do karaoke. My coworker, Sabrina Imbler, brought like a karaoke machine that they'd purchased during the pandemic, just when they were really fiending for karaoke activity. So you could plug it into a laptop and then people just sung songs off of YouTube for way longer than needed to be done.
Now you know where this leads me. I need to know what's the go-to David Roth karaoke song?
So I haven't sung karaoke in a really long time. I don't love it, but I also, my wife really doesn't like it. And so for most of the times that I have been in that position, it's, you know, there were a couple times where, I like the song Islands in the Stream. I thought it would be cool if she and I could sing it together. And we did it a couple times, and then finally she was like, this song is really hard, and I don't like doing it. And I was, you know, when your wife tells you that she does not want to sing the Dolly part to your Kenny, it's a cold shot. You know, have to sort of sit and think with it for a little while, but then you just kind of stop. There's any number of Springsteen songs I could have subjected my coworkers to, probably without having to read the lyrics, but I didn't do that. Mostly I was just excited to watch my coworkers that are serious karaoke heads do the songs that they are most passionate about. I knew that Billy Haasley did a version of Outkast's song Roses, which is like one of the all-time Andre freakouts. There's like a lot of rapping and a lot of singing, and it's really hard. And he's amazing at it. And I was glad I finally got the chance to see that.
See, I don't like doing karaoke, which is weird because I've done a bunch of theater, I don't like that. But what I love about karaoke is seeing those. It's often the people you least expect that become superstars when the music begins.
Yeah, that was the part where I think seeing that people have a song, I think, is a really interesting window into their personalities. That my coworker Justin Ellis didn't do that many songs, but when he did do one, he did Don't Stop Me by Queen, which is just, it's a, you know, even by Queen standards, it's over the top. And it is also like a physical workout. Like there's like 2,500 words in that song, all of them sung at peak Freddie Mercury overage over the course of like 3.5 minutes with an 8-bar guitar break. So it was sort of like watching your friend, take a break from the party that you're at together to just do 50 push-ups. It was just a really like punishing physical ordeal. And then when it was done, he just like grabbed his beer again and somebody else sang, which was remarkable. Being good at singing is a skill that, like, if I could just have it, I think I'd be very happy to have it. But there's only, you need a little bit less self-consciousness than I've got to get up there and be like, I do suck at singing, but I really want to sing Barracuda by heart. You know, like, I can tell when a song is hard and I'm just not going to do it.
David Roth with us here on Downtown. All right, I hate to go from that, but I must ask, was this end of the Mets season the most Metsiest thing in years?
Yeah. So I know that it needs talking about. It was on its way to being bad, and I thought it was just going to get under the wire as normal bad. And then Buck had to sneak in at the last minute the whole Joe Musgrove ear-touching thing. And it was frustrating for me because I've been trying to, in the way you do when your favorite team craps out of the postseason, you kind of make your way through the stages of grief at your own pace. And for me, this was a great season for them. They won 101 games. I had a blast at the ballpark. I loved watching them. Like, it was fun. It was the most fun I've had watching the Mets in a really long time. Obviously, you do not want that season to end in 3 games against the Padres where you barely show up, and you don't want it to end getting one hit by Joe Musgrove. Like, there's a lot of things that were bad that were happening, and as they were happening in that game, I knew they were bad. The fact that they then had to get this in there so that this whole season, that whole series, all of it's going to be like, oh, yeah, the ear team, right? Weren't they the team that got mad about Joe Musgrove's ears? And that's... I mean, I totally understand it, but I'm a little salty about it. I think they did more cool things than that. But if anything, it was nice because it was a good opportunity to talk to people that maybe don't always care about this sort of thing about how weird pitchers are. Because the real story of the Musgrove thing is insane, and you can scandalize normal people simply by explaining it straightforwardly because it would never occur to them to, use Icy Hot in other directed ways to improve your pitching.
I loved your piece on, I never know, is it the Live Tour? Is it the LIV Tour? Or is it just, as I like to call it, the Dismemberment of Journalists Tour?
Right, I was going to say, just the whole Saudi golf thing. I think you're supposed to say Live, even though it's a, little bit of wordplay, because it's only 54 holes, and over the course of the event, and LIV is the Roman numerals for that. It's all very clever, and I'm not just saying that because I don't want to be extrajudicially murdered by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. That's a great concept they came up with. But it's really bleak. I've been fascinated by it. Chris Thompson has written a lot about it at Defector, and I think that we're in an interesting position to cover it because it is... it's perverse. It hasn't really attracted much of an audience yet, but it is really, really strange on the merit that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which is more and more willing to make itself outwardly involved in American politics and public life, just decided to spend a couple billion dollars on something that does not have an audience, that isn't attracting an audience, that didn't have a TV contract set up. They didn't do any of the stuff that you would need to do if you were trying to create a viable sports league. And so the bit of it that's been sort of more interesting to me than the golf, because the golf itself is, happening on a YouTube stream or whatever on the DAZN network, whatever, however you DAZN, while we're talking about things that are hard to pronounce, that it's not consequential. I don't think anybody really cares about it. And yet, like, the question of why any of this is happening is still unanswered. It's not something that, like, I think golf media or even ESPN is really in a position to answer, because it verges so quickly into politics, which is something that they very much want to avoid. And so it's just this strange sort of phenomenon that is happening seemingly unbidden, with no real reason for existing beyond continuing to exist. And then, if you really want to, like, sort of look at it structurally, like, it is very clearly, like, has some elements of being not even, you don't want to say bribes, but it's a political thing. And so all of that being both very obvious on the surface and not talked about and not, like, specifically acknowledged anywhere makes for a really sort of jarring type of experience. And it's more interesting to write about than the PGA Tour.
Yeah, and I like what you said, that it's functioned as truth serum for everyone that touches it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, like, a thing that it hasn't, because, I mean, I'll stop being coy about it. So two of the five events that are being hosted in the United States on that tour are at Trump golf courses.
Right.
There has been, like, Trump has really come out and pushed for it. It feels, and, you know, and the TV deal, such as it exists, that Liv has, is that they're paying Fox Sports to air the broadcasts of it. Like, Fox Sports is not producing it. No network wanted to produce it. So this is a lot of money from a, you know, reactionary autocracy. I don't know what you want to call Saudi Arabia. There's a bunch of nice words that you could use, going to the foremost families in the American conservative political scene, right in front of everybody. And you just either sort of, like, you acknowledge that or you don't. I mean, like, the people that have taken the money, the golfers, at the very least, like, none of them have quite been able to say, I don't care, I needed the money, or I wanted the money. But the rest of it is all sort of, like, just being, it feels like, put through this kind of weird car wash reputationally right in front of our eyes. And, I mean, it's all exactly what it looks like. Trumpism, generally, that is, like, I think it's a defining attribute. Like, it doesn't really hide any of the stuff that's ugly about it. And yet, like, you know, that sort of, it all sort of has the tenor of a taunt. Like, you can see it, and you can see what it is. And the challenge that's implicit in that is, what are you going to do about it? And, you know, it's one thing to say, like, I'm going to vote against the candidate running against this or that politician that is taking money from this or that person. It's harder to do that where, like, Bryson DeChambeau and a golf tour are involved. Like, you can choose to continue not paying attention to it, but the money's going to keep moving, and it's going to keep going to the people it's going to. So it's weird that way.
And while we're talking sports, it's good to see, finally, that Tommy Tuberville has found his mission as a senator. It was not just completely misunderstanding the job that he's getting paid to do, because now he's teamed up with that bastion of democracy, Joe Manchin, to try and find a way to deny opportunities to black athletes.
Yeah, yeah. It's good to have a guy that knows a little something about taking a lot of money that should be going to people who work harder than him in the college sports realm, working on making sure that national image licensing sucks. I think the reason for hope there is that Tommy Tuberville is just not really very good at being a senator or very vigorous about it. Manchin, you know, does tend to get what he wants. I think in this case, I don't know to what extent he really cares about it one way or the other. It's not the sort of thing like a coal slag business that he owns. Something like that's really more of a personal passion. In this case, it feels sort of like just a, you know, sort of a default to the worst possible outcome that he tends to have. But it is strange. I mean, like, Tuberville, not a lot is going to be required of him, right? Like, he will continue to be reelected until he goes to jail or dies, because that's the way that it works if you're in a Republican seat in the state of Alabama. It's just strange to see the things that he cares about. Because in this case, it's like he does seem a little bit engaged, although typically he doesn't really quite seem to know what he's saying.
Right. Speaking
of, I mean, that's the magic of Tommy. I mean, he's been like that. Every now and then he'll pop off and say something that's like really thuddingly racist, and you're kind of like, whoa, wow, like that is supposed to be the subtext, not the text, man. But for the rest of the time, he's just proof of how easy it is to be a senator on energy saver mode. You can just kind of like muddle through and like say whatever everybody else is saying and continue to win by 20 points.
Speaking of people who have no idea what they're saying, the Herschel Walker thing. Now, look, he's not a good person. So every time I start to feel sorry for him a little bit, I think about all the people who have been his victims through the years. But my word, I'm trying hard to think, and Tommy Tuberville might have been the best one, a better example of the Republican Party simply not caring about who they put up for these jobs as long as they get the majority.
Yeah. I mean, I think in this case, it's, you can't exactly say, I mean, obviously I don't have a whole lot of respect for the institutional Republican Party as it exists. In this case, you simply got to tip your cap to the voters there in Ohio and Arizona. They, I mean, obviously it's a different degree of perversity just looking back at Walker's long line of misdeeds since the moment he left the NFL. But the people that were most loyal to Trump did win their nominations in the primaries for the most part. And those people are, you know, like they, whatever it was that they had that won Trump's endorsement, does not seem to be really winning over voters. Like they're kind of, I mean, Blake Masters and J.D. Vance are more in the sort of greasy little freak sycophant vein of Trump endorsees. And Walker, I mean, you know, whatever, he's made a salary off Donald Trump in the USFL. I guess that that's a longstanding relationship there. If you spent 1 year with the New Jersey Generals, you're just down for life. But it's strange that, like, of all the things that you could use to choose a candidate, even if you have political values that I don't have, that in this case, it really did seem to come down to not just who the big man said you should vote for, but who was most willing to abase themselves for that endorsement. Mm. And I would think that that humiliation would be a turnoff. Or, I mean, I would think that if I didn't also think that humiliation is at the core of that movement, like the willingness to humiliate yourself.
Right.
There's a lot of that, like, kind of masochism built into it. Walker, I mean, who knows if he even knows what he's saying, but he's loyal and he doesn't get embarrassed easily. And I guess that's enough.
Good qualities right there. All right. Before we let you go, David, I need your financial advice. Is it too late for me to gather up my paltry life savings and find a way to get it all into an anti-woke bank?
Unfortunately, the anti-woke bank is struggling at this time. This is a story that was in the Wall Street Journal. I recommend it wholeheartedly to everyone. That was out earlier this week. That was about the struggles of an attempt of a Texas startup that was going to finally offer financial services to people without all the woke identity politics stuff that you get from Wells Fargo. Like, this is, it really, of all the things, that, and the story is incredible because everyone that's in it, it's like a Coen brother. Everyone that's involved is drunk after 3 p.m. every day. And all of their ideas seem to be not just like gathered from watching Fox News, but from watching like the commercials on Fox News.
Right, right.
But like, they're like the Tucker stuff they obviously like, but they're really impressed by the ads where like Bob Gunton talks about how gold has never lost value. And they're like, wow, is that true? The warden from Shawshank Redemption said that gold has never lost value. This is amazing. And that, so all of their ideas are, the one that I will share because it stayed in my head is that they wanted to create a special ATM card for people that would become their clients that would be made out of the same material that shell casings are made out of. Finally, a brass card that you could carry in your wallet, which has all the attributes that you look for in a credit card. For instance, it doesn't bend, it's too thick to go in an ATM machine, and it screws up the chips. And so they started manufacturing them, realized it was impossible, stopped, and have then since tried to come up with, I think they finally settled on like a regular credit card that was just the color of brass. But the fact that they went prototype mode on this and were basically sort of like finally a combination of weaponry and being able to boop your chip at Shaw's and get your groceries really lets you know the level of candle power is involved here. But yes, everyone, please do seek out the story. I can find the headline for you if you give me 1 second.
If I get that card, I just hope I can use it to get my Glenn Beck survival rations.
It really has that feeling where, like, just the fact, like, if you see someone break that card out, you know everything about them that you know. But anyway, apologies for not being able to get the headline up right away. But it's in the journal. If you search anti-woke bank Wall Street Journal online, it will be a part of your permanent search record, but you will find the story.
Yeah, we're looking at it right now. It's titled, How a New Anti-Woke Bank Stumbled.
Yeah, not to give too much away. The answer is repeatedly.
David Roth with us here on Downtown, living in Allentown, but only for a moment. David, thank you. As always, great to catch up with you. Work those karaoke skills. And again, I know she won't do it, but I want to hear you and your wife just one time for me do Islands in the Stream.
It would be, I think, now that she knows that my friend at Bangor wants it, like, maybe this is, I have a little bit of leverage. So I appreciate it, man. Thank you, as always.
We rely on each other. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Indeed.
Thanks, David.
Bye.
David Roth, Defector.com, the Distraction Podcast.